Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
This is Basketball History 101 with Rick Loaiza.
Welcome back to award-winning Basketball History 101, part of the Sports History Network. I am your host, Rick Loaiza, and this is a podcast where we bring to life some of the forgotten stories from basketball history. We are bringing old-school basketball to a new-school audience. And today we bring you part two of the Red Auerbach story. In the previous episode, I shared Auerbach's upbringing in Brooklyn and how he made second-team All-Brooklyn when he was a player in high school. He then started his college ball at Seth Lowe Junior College in Manhattan. And after a year, he was able to transfer on a basketball scholarship to George Washington University in Washington, D.C., where he found an amazing coach in Bill Reinhardt. Reinhardt would be a mentor to Auerbach for decades, and Auerbach also met his wife at George Washington. Now, after a few years of coaching high school basketball and a stint coaching basketball in the Navy during World War II, it finally came time for Auerbach to get a job to support his wife. Having only coached high school and in the Navy, he cold-called the Washington Capitals of the brand new Basketball Association of America, or BAA, and convinced the ownership to hire him as their first head coach. The thing that was really weird about it is that I always knew that Auerbach was the great Celtics head coach, but until I started doing research for this story, I had no idea that he had coached elsewhere in the early days of the NBA. In fact, Auerbach was one of the 11 original head coaches in the NBA. Now, after coaching for 3 years with the Washington Capitals to great success, the ownership decided to fire him and find somebody else. It was obvious that Auerbach was a great coach. In his first year, he had the best record in the league by a wide margin. In his third year, he went all the way to the finals, but lost to the Minneapolis Lakers, and no shame there. But it seemed that Auerbach could not win in the playoffs when the games really counted. So he looked for help from his extensive basketball network of friends and buddies that he made in the Navy. Was there a team out there that needed a head coach? At the time, there were no openings in the NBA, so Auerbach was open to coaching a college team, and that is where Duke University came in. Yes, we are talking about the same Duke University where Coach Mike Krzyzewski won 5 national championships and coached 72 future NBA players. This is a school where Auerbach found a job. Now, that may surprise many of you, and it practically shocked me. I said to myself, wow, Auerbach coached at Duke? How did I not know that before? Well, here's why I did not know that before. He was only the coach there for about a month in the summer and never actually coached a game. Now, as it turns out, Bob Kerner, the owner of the Tri-Cities Blackhawks, got rid of his coach and needed someone else to step in and take over the reins of the team. So he reached out to Auerbach to become their new head coach. And just as he had done with the Washington Capitals, Auerbach said that he would only coach the Blackhawks under one condition, that he would have the final say in all basketball personnel matters. Basically, Auerbach wanted full control of the team and for the owner to stay out of the way. He knew that this was the best way to achieve on-court success. I mean, the guy was not wrong. He was an excellent coach and an incredibly astute evaluator of talent, but I can also see where some owners might have a hard time with that. However, Kerner agreed to Auerbach's terms and hired him as the new head coach in Tri-Cities. By the way, in case you are wondering, the Tri-Cities area is right on the Mississippi River between Illinois and Iowa. It includes the cities of Davenport, Iowa, and the cities of Rock Island and Moline, Illinois. Now, later, the city of East Moline, Illinois grew to such a size that it was included in the group and the area was renamed the Quad Cities. In any case, this is where Red Auerbach coached with the Blackhawks. Now, the season did not go so great for Auerbach as he had the only losing season of his entire coaching career. The Blackhawks finished with a record of 29-35, but still made the playoffs. and they were bounced out in the first round 2-0 by the Anderson Packers. When the season ended, he quit. Now, he did not quit because of the losing season. He was a better person than that. Remember how he told the owner the previous summer that he would only coach if he had final say on all basketball matters? Well, the owner, Bob Kerner, made a trade near the end of the season without telling Auerbach about it ahead of time. Auerbach did not find out about the trade until after it was a done deal, and this he would not abide. Auerbach quit and told Kerner that he had broken his promise to stay out of player matters. Of course, Kerner defended himself by saying that it was an opportunity that he could not pass up, and after all, he was the owner and could do what he wanted. And in a sense, that is true. The Blackhawks organization belonged to Kerner, but a promise is a promise. Now, after having to look for a job the previous summer, Auerbach was again looking for a job. As it so happened, the head coach of the Boston Celtics, Alvin Julian, had quit after 2 losing seasons. In fact, in 4 seasons of basketball, the Boston Celtics had never had a winning season up to that point. The owner of the Celtics, Walter Brown, desperately wanted to see the Celtics become a winning team. However, the Celtics were bleeding money, as were most of these original NBA teams. But Walter Brown loved basketball and he loved his Celtics. He even once mortgaged his house just to make payroll and keep the Celtics alive. Brown had poured so much of his own money into the Celtics that if the Celtics failed and went out of business, Brown risked going bankrupt. That is how much he was tied into the financial success of the team. Anyway, Brown consulted with a committee of 9 sports writers to help him find a new head coach. Now, that just seems preposterous by today's standards. I mean, can you imagine, say, Clippers owner Steve Ballmer putting together a committee of Stephen A. Smith, Skip Bayless, Zach Lowe, Brian Windhorst, and Rachel Nichols to help him find a new head coach? Today, you would never see sports writers having a say in which person was hired to be a head coach in any sport. To make a long story short, they found and hired Red Auerbach, who had recently resigned from the Blackhawks. Again, Auerbach wanted the Celtics' coaching position on one condition, that he have final say on all player personnel matters. And Walter Brown was fine with that. Also, Walter Brown was a man of his word. He often made suggestions or asked questions, but when it came down to making a draft pick or making a trade, he put all his trust in Red Auerbach to make the final decision. Auerbach was now the head coach of the Boston Celtics, and this is a good place to take a break, and we'll be right back with more on Red Auerbach.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, and so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings your sports history to life anywhere. The Row One Gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One Shop, check out the thousands more of unique items with a retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW number one, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items. Plus, get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes.
Hello, sports history fans. I'm Ross from the podcast Pigskin Tales. You're about to jump into another thrilling sports history moment, but first, let's dive into today's sponsor, just in time for the holiday season. Introducing Art of Words, the brainchild of word artist Dan Duffy from Philadelphia. Dan meticulously crafts stunning images by handwriting relevant words from some of the greatest sports moments in time. These unique budget-friendly illustrations are the perfect gift, sparking cherished memories and capturing hearts. Choose from city skylines, sports, history, and musicians to find a piece for everyone. And here's the exciting part. For that sports fanatic in your life, gift them a piece of their favorite team or player's history. Art of Words tells a compelling story. Explore collegiate stadiums, each meticulously crafted with every football victory etched into words. Or venture into baseball stadiums, handwritten with every player from the team's illustrious history. My favorite on the site is Bryce Harper 2021 MVP year. Because I'm a big stats guy, I think that's one of the coolest things ever. Check it out. Don't wait. Order a print today for yourself and your loved one this holiday season. Transform your wall into a gallery of captivating art and surprise your family and friends with a print of their own. Use code SHN15 at artofwords.com for a 15% discount on your order in November and December. Visit Art of Words, where words magically transform into stunning art, evoking cherished memories and touching the hearts of those who you care about. Again, use the code SHN15 for 15% off at artofwords.com.
Welcome back to the show, and let us continue with the story of Red Auerbach. He had just been hired as the new head coach of the Boston Celtics. Now, before we begin with his time on the Celtics bench, I want to share something that is a bit off for a head coach in any sport. Even though he was now working in Boston, he maintained his official residence in Washington, D.C. Now, as I mentioned in the previous episode, once Auerbach left New York to play basketball for George Washington University, he never again lived anywhere except Washington, D.C. for the rest of his life. His wife, Dorothy, and their two girls maintained their home in Washington, and it was an unusual arrangement, but it worked for them. In fact, Auerbach never even bought a home in Boston. He lived in extended stay hotels where he paid by the month. He would then go home to Washington as often as possible, which was difficult as a coach, but he was able to spend more time in Washington once he moved into the front office full time. And he was hired by the Celtics in the summer of 1950, just in time for the draft that summer. Everyone in Boston was telling Auerbach that he had to take Bob Cousy from the College of the Holy Cross, located just outside of Boston. For some reason, Auerbach did not want Bob Cousy. He did not like the fancy passing that Cousy was known for. Of course, it was exciting and Cousy could sell a lot of tickets, but Auerbach did not believe in fancy passing or any of that hot dog kind of basketball. He wanted players that were 100% committed to winning basketball games. He believed in a philosophy that an NBA team would sell more tickets by winning than by signing a bunch of local college kids. He felt that the fans would not care where a player played his college ball as long as the team was winning. And I have to agree with Auerbach. I did an entire episode about how Cousy was not wanted by the Celtics, but ended up on the Celtics anyway. That is episode 42 if you want to go back and check it out. So what does Auerbach do in his first season in Boston? He went 39-30 to secure the first winning season in the Celtics' short history. They finished just one victory behind the Philadelphia Warriors in the East and easily secured a playoff spot. But they got knocked out of the playoffs in the first round by losing 2-0 to the New York Knicks. But he had something going with Bob Cousy and Easy Ed McCauley, a pair of 22-year-old future Hall of Famers who led the team with 16 points and 22 points per game, respectively. He just needed to make some moves with the other players in the team to continue building something in Boston. Now, the following year, Auerbach was able to add another future Hall of Famer in Bill Sharman when Auerbach's old team, the Washington Capitals, went out of business. Now, that year, they finished with a record of 39-27, but got knocked out of the playoffs in the first round again by the New York Knicks. But Auerbach could smell that something was starting to cook with this team. By the way, now that the Celtics had a winning record, attendance increased by an average of 2,000 tickets per game. The Celtics were now making money, and that took a lot of pressure off the owner, Walter Brown. He slowly kept adding to the Celtics roster and getting better every year. Now, a few years later, in the summer of 1956, Auerbach had his eyes on a guy that could absolutely transform the Celtics. In fact, the season before, he even told Bob Cousy that there was a college kid out in California, and if the Celtics could land him, they would start winning championships. That player was the great Bill Russell. Auerbach just had to have him. But in order to get him, he needed to move up in the draft order. And he set his eyes on the St. Louis Hawks, who were owned by his former boss, Bob Kerner. In order to keep this story straight, the old Tri-Cities Blackhawks relocated to St. Louis and changed their nickname to just Hawks. And Kerner was the owner of that team the whole time. Anyway, Auerbach had to offer quite a bit in order to land the Hawks pick. Auerbach offered Kerner two future Hall of Famers in Easy Ed McCauley and Cliff Hagan. Now that is a no-brainer if you are St. Louis. Two current All-Stars for one draft pick? Well, that's an easy exchange. So St. Louis made the trade and Auerbach used that pick to take Bill Russell from the University of San Francisco. Now, just as Arbuck had predicted, Bill Russell was the key to unlocking the now-famous Celtics fast break. Alongside Bob Cousy, Bill Sharman, Jim Loskutov, Tommy Heinsohn, and Frank Ramsey, the Celtics became unstoppable. And they made it all the way to the finals against the St. Louis Hawks, the team that they traded with to get Bill Russell. In one way, it was a win-win situation. The Hawks became tremendously better when they received McCauley and Hagen, the two players that the Celtics gave them for Russell. Now, here is one of the craziest stories from those finals. The series was tied at one game apiece when the Celtics traveled to St. Louis to play Game 3. Before the game started, Red Auerbach called the refs over and questioned the height of the rims. The referees measured the rims and confirmed that they were indeed 10 feet high. However, the owner of the Hawks, Bob Kerner, took exception to it and confronted Auerbach at midcourt. Kerner was screaming and yelling. Auerbach went back mentally to his days as a youth in Brooklyn. The old saying was to hit the other guy before he hit you. And with that on his mind, Auerbach hit Kerner with a right-handed roundhouse. I mean, he just plain sucker punched Kerner at midcourt. As players from both teams looked over to see what the commotion was about, there was Auerbach and Kerner rolling around on the floor, punching and scratching and wrestling each other while wearing suits. It was like a businessman's version of a West Side Story rumble. The two men were separated and went back to their respective benches. And here is where it gets even crazier. There were no fouls, no ejections, no fines, nothing. Since the game had not even started yet, there were no consequences. The two men were simply separated, and then they started the game like nothing had even happened. The following season, the NBA put in a rule that if someone punches an owner, that person would be automatically fined $300. Now, the Celtics lost that Game 3, but came back to win the entire series in double overtime of Game 7. The final score was 125-123, and the Celtics had finally won a championship. Auerbach finally won the games when they counted. Now, the following year in 1958, the Celtics and the Hawks had a rematch in the NBA Finals. However, Bill Russell was playing on a severely injured ankle and was pretty much ineffective. The Hawks took the series for their only championship in their team's history. The Celtics then retooled, regrouped, and came back with a vengeance in 1959. That was the year that they started the streak of winning 8 championships in a row. Now, this is a good place to wrap up part 2 of the Red Auerbach story. We will be back next week with the Celtics' 8-year run of championships and with Auerbach's decision to leave coaching and move into the Celtics' front office full-time. That's next time on Basketball History 101, part of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of Sports Yesteryear. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com to find out more about this and other sports history podcasts. If you like what you hear, please hit that subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. And check out our page on Facebook. It's called Basketball History 101 Podcast. There you will find shorter historical posts as well as comments and discussion starters on today's game. I'll also announce there when new episodes come out. I want to thank my producer and editor, Jacob Loaiza. Join us each week as we continue to mine the history of basketball for more great stories of the past. Take care and see you soon.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
This is Mark Mortier, and if you're a sports history fan like me, tune in and hear me talk about some great sports moments of the past. Growing up during the 1970s, I got to watch some of the most iconic moments in sports history. Hank Aaron breaking Babe Ruth's home run record. Willis Reed limping out of the locker room in Game 7 of the NBA Finals at Madison Square Garden as the fans erupted with a thunderous ovation. The 1980 Miracle on Ice as Team USA defeated the powerful Soviet Union in the Olympics. Listen every Tuesday on Yesterday Sports.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.